It's Monday, December 28th, 2020. The last Monday of 2020. This is LA Podcast. It is our end of year show. I'm here with Hayes Davenport and Alyssa Walker. My name is Scott Frazier. Hayes, Alyssa, how are you guys?
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Happy Boxing Day.
You saying that it's the last episode of 2020 has me feeling myself a little bit, and for all of us, that we made it through this entire year. Have we ever missed a week? I don't think so.
No, we never have. We never have. We've had individual people not be here, but we've never taken a week off, no matter how much independently the three of us might have wanted to do that. We've always persevered.
It's the cause for celebration by others of us, I think, or should be.
That's right.
That's what I'm in the mind of at the end of this year. Yeah, I mean, I was listening to our year-end episode.
Come all ye faithful podcast listeners.
I was listening to our year-end episode from last year where we were talking about very different stuff. This is normally the time of year that we are all complaining about the flyaway bus in different ways.
God. Now we complain about it for different reasons.
Wow.
Yeah.
That feels like
right?
a broadcast from a different reality.
We spent 10 minutes at the top of the last episode that I'm just going beat by beat of being the flyaway bus being 2 hours late for me.
I mean, how is Lagsit doing? Lagsit. What is it? Lax?
Lagsit.
I purged it from my memory. How's
yeah,
it doing?
That's actually not a phrase that I've thought about in
9 months.
How do
you think it's doing? I think it's doing good.
That could easily have been the thing that we talked about more than anything this year, and instead we didn't talk about it at all. But yeah, I mean, I'm excited to get into what has like, sort of the arc of the city over the last year. We're going to look back on what our wishes were for the coming year.
Yep.
And also what we considered to be the biggest stories of the year in LA, and then we're going to make new wishes for next year for 2021. But first, we have a lot of stuff to get into from this week. First of all, we had a holiday party that was so fun.
So fun.
It was inside at La Scala, Beverly Hills. Thank you for everyone for keeping it discreet.
That was the decoy we sent out. We had Alyssa break this story and send out a fake letter for a party a week from now. That was cover for the one that we were actually having a few days ago. So fun. So nice to see so many friends of the show. Councilmember Mike Bonin was there. Lots of journalists from all over the city. People that have been guests before and just like general supporters. There were like something like 150 people there. So many subscribers to the Sepulveda Pass. The closest thing I've felt to like a real community experience, really.
It felt like a party.
That was actually like the only social event of 2020 that I attended. I'm pretty sure the only one. And yeah, so for our listeners, we did this on Zoom. We had actually done a holiday party at Alyssa's house. Very, very graciously, Alyssa hosted our guests from 2019 at the end of last year. And then we wanted to keep that rolling, but obviously not really possible in person during the worst surge of the pandemic here in Los Angeles County. So what we did instead was invited all of our Patreon subscribers who help us keep this show going, along with, you know, more recent and less recent guests on the program, everybody who has been a part of helping us keep the show relevant and active in the Los Angeles media space. And it was a blast. I enjoyed having everybody on there.
We'll definitely do it again, I think, for another, not exactly the same, but we should definitely do for our pass holders. It was too much fun.
So before we get into the rest of the weekend news, we want to sum up the update on the COVID outbreak this week. We have continued to see record-setting numbers of new cases. The number of people currently hospitalized continues to rise. Deaths are now catching up with those numbers. We saw the highest numbers yet in deaths, between 130 and 150 people reported having died in single days at different points in the week. But so one of two things is happening. We are starting to plateau in terms of the number of new cases announced. It's kind of sticking around the 13,000 to 16,000 a day range.
Yeah.
And hospitalizations are also increasing more slowly. Over the last couple days, it was less than 100 new additions to the number of total hospitalized every day. Either that is happening or there are reporting issues and we just don't know exactly how bad it's getting. You've got the holiday, which mm-hmm. always fucks everything up in terms of what's being reported. And you have, there was a Spectrum outage, I guess, and that made it impossible for, like, for example, yesterday there were 5 deaths reported by LA County Public Health
right.
of COVID,
right.
and the number, unfortunately, was much, much higher than that. We just don't know exactly what it
so
was.
So that, I didn't right. know anything about that outage, but then it was the same day of that Nashville bombing. It just made me wonder, yeah. which also targeted a, you know, AT&T center. I was just wondering right. if that was
Did
some
it.
Kind of, yeah, knocked out their service. Like, for I think like a majority of the city, I think, lost all types of telecommunication services. But that made me really paranoid. I don't know. Like, think of you, if what you wanted to do was like disrupt the reporting systems, if you were some kind of denier or truther.
Right.
I don't know. I got all conspiracy theoried out about it the other night, but
there is not really any information about the Spectrum outage other than that it happened
yeah.
and apparently prevented Department of Public Health and DHS from reporting the most up-to-date numbers of deaths. Those will come in, obviously, eventually. But like you're saying, Hayes, we've seen a slowdown. It's hard. It's really hard to say at this point what that means. Actually, it's not the easiest thing to say is that it doesn't mean anything for people
right.
who are trying to determine what is the safe course of action for them. We still have, I think, something in the neighborhood of one out of every like 70 to 80 people in the county is presumed to be capable of transmitting the disease at this point in time. We're between 2 major holidays, and we won't know the impact of the Christmas holiday for several
yeah.
days or weeks hence from now. I personally saw a lot of people talking on social media and indeed in my own neighborhood traveling, like clearly traveling for the Christmas holiday. I saw somebody on my block with their suitcases packed, getting into an Uber to go to presumably LAX. And those sorts of decisions, just like with Thanksgiving, we can sort of expect will have impacts that will become known after, probably after New Year.
And I heard from at least one person who flew into LAX after the holiday that there was no mention of that quarantine document that the mayor introduced a few weeks ago, where you have mm-hmm. to fill out a form saying that you promise to quarantine. I don't know. It's like a pinky swear. I don't know. But it still would have been good to have some sort
when
of information
arrive.
When you arrive. Yeah, when you land in LA, you're supposed to fill out this form or get a form or have them talk to you about a form. But that did not happen. And so you wonder if even like people flying in from like the UK, are they even getting any kind of information?
Well, now there is, on the federal level, I know that there's some sort of travel restrictions
yes.
between the US and the UK
yes.
as a result of this newer, more readily contagious version of the COVID virus that they have identified there, which it is still believed will be treated by the or prevented by the vaccine that is entering circulation now. But it's interesting, like from a state level standpoint, you know, like we have seen a wide variety of a wide variety of approaches to countering the spread of the pandemic over the course of 2020. A lot of states obviously have decided that they are not going to make like real efforts to contain the spread of the disease. Some states and indeed some foreign countries have made the decision that they're going to attempt to let the virus basically burn through their population until there is some sort of herd immunity, which has cost a lot of people their lives, obviously. But there's, I think, also models that could have been emulated in California that weren't. For example, Hawaii implemented a very strict quarantine procedure. California never did. Like like you're saying, Alyssa, people coming into the state, they pinky swear that they're going to like be safe or whatever. There's a lot of there's no clear directive on what it is that means in a way that I think would meaningfully impact health outcomes for people. And there were a lot of calls from people, I think especially after Thanksgiving, for the city of Los Angeles to close LAX, which also didn't happen.
Yeah.
But what difference really would, as far as LA is concerned, you talk about like people traveling in and out of the county. Like, this is the epicenter of COVID in the United States. We can only really spread it elsewhere.
Right.
Like, people coming in are almost by definition going to dilute the number of people who with like positive cases. Like, The Guardian had a big article by Sam Levin this week just saying, like, it's still and has been for weeks. LA and so California is bringing down the average and like the progress that's being made in the rest of the country, and LA is bringing it down for California. It's like mm-hmm. LA and Fresno and like a couple other places mm-hmm. in California are where this is all happening. And so travel now, I think, is secondary to community spread here. I mean, like, travel, I guess, means that people are going to be convening in homes, and so new people are going to get it.
Right.
But I, you know, it just feels like it's fate at this point. It's just a foregone conclusion that it's going to burn out here to some extent.
I was feeling really sad about it. But then on Christmas Eve day, I went for a long run and I saw so many people in my neighborhood eating outside. Mm-hmm. Or right. even like on the street and on the sidewalk. Like, I was so heartened by seeing, it was a beautiful day. I mean, it wasn't like, it was kind of like cloudy, I think, the day before. And then it rained a little bit on Christmas Eve. So it was Christmas Day. And then the next day was like this beautiful blue sky day. And it would make me feel so good to just run around and inhale like the smoking meats and see some people wearing masks like in their backyards with other people. You know, I'm so nosy, but it did make me feel like, at least in my neighborhood, people were taking it really seriously. It was good to see.
I do want to say, though, like, when we talk about, so I think I understand where you're coming from, Hayes, but at the same time, like, it can still get much worse here. Like, there's not really, like, as bad as things are currently, the rate of transmission here over the last week, according to the New York Times, 136 people out of every 100,000 people in LA County have tested positive for COVID in the last 7 days. That's quite bad. But that is also not the worst number in the country. Like, in terms of the last week's data, we're something like 30th to 40th out of counties in the U.S. So very near the top, but there are a lot of places that are doing considerably worse than us. These numbers go up to a few outlier counties with like 400 residents per 100,000 contracting COVID in the last week. Things can still get a lot worse here. And that's, I think that although we are the epicenter for COVID for the country, it's certainly not the case that we're at the bottom of where we could conceivably be.
I agree it could get a lot worse, and I guess I'm sort of a fatalist about it. It just feels like that is going to happen, certainly for hospitals. We've been saying for weeks
Yeah.
There's nothing to keep all the people that are getting newly infected out of the hospital. There's no policy change even being explored right. that I know of that would make any significant difference.
It's all the same things. It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's been all the same. It's really just like the approach has really just been louder for the people in the back. And they're just like, it's right. there's no new anything being brought to bear.
And behavioral change, people either are bought into it at this point or it's just not really going to happen. I mean, I don't know what social media post is going to change someone's mind about it. And let's talk about some, like, an institution that famously is not buying into it. The restaurant in Beverly Hills. Alyssa, take us through what happened in your mentions.
Let's take a step by step through my
read
mentions.
Every one of your mentions.
And yeah, this is like, so the one other thing too, that is going to affect the whole country is the decision that indoor worship was allowed for Christmas too. And that was happening even in LA County, even though they recommended that people should be outside. I did see some people having services inside, which was very, that was very frightening. So another place that people want to gather indoors that you cannot is a restaurant. We have heard, meaning I'm sure a lot of members of the media, there's been a lot of things can be handled if you have enough money and you could have a private party, whether in your home or in someone else's, you know, location. This has been going on the whole time, of course. But this was a particularly brazen incident. A friend passed me what her friend had gotten in their takeout bag from La Scala, their famous chop salad.
So much of the reporting around this,
it always
was free promo for La Scala. Like, you must try the chop salad.
Which I've heard has really gone downhill in recent years. But, and
I've never been to La Scala.
Well, I haven't either.
I've never eaten the chop salad.
So you get these little... you're just printing out pieces of paper. And I confirmed that it was from there and other people have gotten it because my mentions are full of people that said I made this up, but yet they're also going to go to the restaurant and order food anyway. Just in case I didn't make it up.
That'll teach you, Alyssa.
But it's like a very like funnily worded, like trying to be wink, wink, like, oh, this is a prohibition style party we're throwing for New Year's Eve. Indoors, very discreet, tell all your friends. But I mean, I don't understand how they could think the outcome would have been anything but this, which leads to the other part of my mentions, which is people who think they did this on purpose to advertise to the type of people who are advocating for indoor dining to take place, which would make sense in Beverly Hills, where there's a lot of people like that. So
Trump voters.
They'll probably get a lot. Thanks, Scott, for filling
I don't know if we ever circled back to that, but we can now officially say that Beverly Hills is full of Trump voters.
We are calling Beverly Hills for Donald Trump.
Tell us, Scott.
It was a moment in time where, like, you had to endure being like, yeah, well, they, you know, it's Beverly Hills, but it's blue, so, like, all the reporting is Beverly Hills is liberal. Now we don't have to take that anymore. Beverly Hills is Trump country.
And you said it had gotten so much redder since the last election. So it has intensified in a very troubling direction. So we have this business also that hasn't responded publicly since this happened, since I posted that tweet, which is also... surely someone has told them that this is happening, or they're putting another apology out in the same like script font and they need to get it typeset or something in the by there. I just don't know.
In-house
I don't
calligrapher.
Know. And it's not like, but the thing I think is, you know, it's been picked up by like now Fox News and all these other places. So literally RIP my mentions, but I will say like, nothing will happen to them because they didn't do anything wrong, technically.
Mm-hmm.
And the Beverly Hills Police Department responded to my tweet. Right. People were tagging them and they were like, we're on it. And apparently there was an LA Times story where they talked to the police department in Beverly Hills and they're like, yes, we talked to them on Christmas Eve. So they had talked to them. They had talked to the restaurant on Thursday. This was already out there and people knew, mm-hmm. people were sending them this hot tip to their code enforcement line. So they know. But if you look at what's happened to other places like malls, the malls we talked about last week, a bunch of them got fined for right. letting more than 20% capacity people in and also allowing food and drinking when they shouldn't have. And all they got was a $500 fine. A $500 mm-hmm. fine.
For a mall.
For a mall.
An entire mall.
for a whole ass mall. I saw recently that Eddie Murphy is coming back for a sequel to Coming to America. Maybe he will also reboot Beverly Hills Cop and they can make this a centerpiece of that movie, shutting down La Scala during COVID. I like the thing that is funny about this to me is that they are self-consciously saying like, oh, it's like a speakeasy sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't recall like it being a centerpiece of speakeasy culture that you would write down the time and place that you were intending on breaking the law.
It's a tell all your friends.
Like just totally incompetent unless the goal is just to, like you guys are saying, get people aware that they are opposed to the continued closures and just reach out to those people.
If you look on their Instagram, they very much are. And they have like a whole series of stories where it's like, you know, we hate Gavin Newsom and even mad at the mayor of Beverly Hills. And I mm-hmm. guess the windows at Kitson have this
That's been going on for quite a while.
I wish somebody had told me about this sooner because I would have gone by. But they all their windows are like plastered over with like news headlines from the year mm-hmm. of the pandemic and like F right. you, Gavin Newsom type things too. So,
I love this story. Of course, it speaks to me very deeply. If anybody that we know does show up at La Scala for this party, please let us know what your experience is like. I wonder if there's enough even people to float a business based on hatred for COVID closures in Los Angeles. I know that Times editorial board certainly thinks that there are, but I'm curious about the business strategy of being in the heart of the LA basin and broadcasting this.
Guess how much the chop salad is, the full chop salad.
Well, let's see. 30.
It's only $12.50. It's a lot cheaper that's a lot cheaper than I
thought.
Yeah,
but how big is that? That's like Beverly Hills full.
Yeah, sure.
That means
so
you
who
don't
knows.
Actually eat it.
But it's a lot cheaper than the Musso and Frank Chicken Caesar, which is $20. Let's move on to... So we're heading into 2021. New city council, new mayor... Essentially, like the mayor is committed to seeing out his second term.
Isn't that what I said last time? Remember, I said he has nothing to lose. Go for it.
Mm-hmm.
Go for it.
And he is going for it.
From your lips to Garcetti's ears.
He is reestablishing his power. And so now many of the people in leadership in LA are just openly fighting heading into 2021. We talked about in a recent episode how the money that had been reallocated from the LAPD budget towards social justice causes that is meant to uplift communities of color in the wake of the Black Lives Matter uprising, that money was... allocated and spent a lot of it by the city council. Some of it is being held over, but about $90 million was distributed and spent between the different city council districts. There was some criticism on this show that it sort of landed softly with the money being spent on sidewalk repair and streetlights in some places. But in response to that, City Council President Nuri Martinez, who had been one of the architects of this system, said this is what low-income communities of color need, and richer parts of the city like take it for granted, but we need our streets to be lit. We need our sidewalks to be passable. But apparently the mayor agreed that this was not the best use of this money, and he vetoed the entire allocation. Late right. at night on Monday night, he sent out this letter saying, "I'm not signing this, or I am signing this that vetoes it. And here are some of the different approaches we can take, but it sort of amounts to a starting from scratch."
Yeah.
Interestingly, he said that he did agree with the city council's decision to chop it up among different districts, prioritizing the lower income districts like Curran Prices and Marquise Harris Dawson's in South LA, but he didn't agree with what the money was spent on. The Nuri Martinez responded saying that she was did not agree with the mayor's veto. Marquise Harris Dawson, city council member, said that it was progressive gobbledygook, this letter. I heard that from a bunch of different people that Martinez and Garcetti had been going back and forth on this to maybe like come up with, like, this is before the veto, to come up with a new way to spend this money. But those talks kind of broke down and culminated in the mayor signing this letter. So now it seems like Martinez and other members of the city council are going to try and put together 10 votes out of 15 to override the veto. And the phrase that I've heard used by multiple people is that mommy and daddy are fighting.
You know what? This is to me, when I saw news that Garcetti had done this veto, by all accounts, you're saying that Nuri Martinez and Garcetti had entered into some late talks to try and forestall this eventuality. But by many accounts, at least in the LA Times, council members were saying that they didn't even know that this was a possibility. I mean, obviously they knew it was a technical thing that Garcetti has the ability to do, but that he would veto this specific council file was not something that was on their radar or that Garcetti had reached out to them to let them know. And mayoral vetoes are very rare. Like,
yeah,
we had the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn for the first time in 800 years this past week, and the mayoral veto happens like slightly more frequently than that. It is not something that I think was on anyone's radar. And as you were saying, Hayes, I had at least been pretty critical of this plan, of the way that the money was broken down and allocated. I think I called it a slush fund, as I often do. In these cases, the council members have infinite discretion to do whatever it is that they think is going to, I mean, basically whatever they think it is that's going to make them look good in the present moment.
Yeah.
There's not really any forethought or like even anything that could be followed up on afterwards to determine, is this money being well spent? It's really just, here's a kitty and you get to just use whatever money you want out of it. Enjoy. So I was critical of that and remain so. I think that Council President Martinez's point that this is what low-income communities actually need sort of falls flat, considering the fact that this is something that City Council had to have their arms twisted in order to do, to take this money from LAPD in order to spend it on other things. It's not like they came to the city of LA and said, we need to invest this money. We're responding to the constituents coming to us through a normal process. This was a widespread culture of public demonstrations that arose over the summer that were tied to very clear, in my opinion, demands. And if they weren't clear, they were then expounded upon at great length in the council chamber. So for Councilmember Martinez to say this is an example of like whoever not listening to constituents as well as her and her colleagues do seems to me not well founded. And so for that reason alone, I found myself sort of disposed to appreciate what the mayor did here. That being said, I think one of the things that we had talked about was the amount of money we're talking about, $90 million. And what did Garcetti say that he actually wanted that money to go towards?
Nothing really specific. I mean, you can kind of tell is what he would really like, especially in the aftermath of a new federal money being spent and none of it going to state and local governments. They were really hoping to get another cash infusion like they did in the first CARES Act. They didn't get it. And so now you have this $600 to $900 million hole in the city budget still. Mm-hmm. Garcetti has been talking almost every time he's opened his mouth over the last few weeks about how those furloughs, the cuts that are going to be made to the city budget are going to fall hardest on people of color, the targeted local hire program, because the deals with the unions are that it's a last in, first out system. It's a lot of young people who have been given job opportunities by the city who are going to lose their jobs as a result of these cuts. So I think what he would love is just for as much of this money as possible to go patch like a little piece of the hole in the city budget and frame that as a social justice initiative.
Mm. Right.
He mentioned that in the letter, but beyond that, there wasn't a specific plan. He said he wants it to be specifically targeted toward racial justice and income inequality or alternatives to policing, but nothing really, really specific.
Yeah, it was like funding pilot, like what had been already talked about, funding pilots for new models of policing. That was like the last bullet point. He really focused almost exclusively on what you had said, this notion that city government needs to find funding sources to stave off layoffs. I think that's something that all of us agree with. But his argument was essentially like that there are among the city's workforce people who are disproportionately likely to be victimized by police violence, such as the kind that was talked about by Black Lives Matter, because they are Black or because they are Latino, and that in order to protect those people's jobs, it was necessary to redirect this money to his specific pet projects. It's basically, he is basically doing the same thing that city council is doing. He's just saying, I want this to go to the things that I want it to go to instead of you having it go to these other. It's really not an address of the underlying critique of the distribution of this money. And ultimately, it is sort of in a way, it's sort of a tempest in a teacup because it's such a small amount of money that there's not really a lot being accomplished here anyway. Mm-hmm. But from another perspective, I think it is actually quite consequential. We're talking about Alyssa saying, you know, just go for it, start doing whatever it is that is important to the city, and maybe try and like change the legacy you're leaving behind to Mayor Garcetti. I think we are starting to get a sense of what are Garcetti's priorities as he closes out the end of his second term in office, his last term as mayor, and it's not great. Like, I mean, if you think about it, like this was his second thing that he did. The first one was the helipad thing that we talked about last week.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So during that time when he could have conceivably been going back and forth with council members about what do you spend this money on, he wasn't focused on that. He was instead looking at these, you know, sort of like pie in the sky, innovative strategies that he loves to focus on. But then when it comes to actually governing, you know, actually like coordinating with city council to make sure that we get what we need, and to be fair, there's no help coming right now from any level of government. But that just doesn't seem like it's a top priority still.
It might be to buy a little bit of time, because think of when the veto happened, we weren't quite sure what was going to happen at the federal level at that moment. And then it ended up that we still don't know, like you said, what kind of help is coming at all, even for the people as like, you know, these checks, these relief checks that desperately need it. But I also wonder, too, if it's buying us a little more time to see what the Biden administration will prioritize for cities. Because, for example, FEMA has already said that they are going to give federal money to Project Home Key, the state's program to purchase hotels for people to live in. So I wonder if by spinning this around and waiting a little bit longer, we might get a sense of where we don't have to pay for things that might be coming from the White House or Congress. You know, it could be completely different. And then you're right, Scott, like the other thing, the other component that's missing here is going back to the original reason that this happened, that amazing meeting that we talk about that happened in council chambers where we had Black Lives Matter give this very emotional argument for why this money needs to, you know, the budget needs to change. So who is talking to them at this point and saying, hey, does this look right to you? And the surveys that you took of all these people in the city, and you have to hope that maybe that back channel is occurring? Because if it's not, this is useless.
They said Black Lives Matter came out and said that they approve of the mayor's veto.
Yes.
They do want this money repurposed for more specifically targeted programs. That said, I mean, he's going to need their help to get this over. If this was him reasserting authority and saying, like, hey, remember who the mayor is here, the bitch is back, I don't think this will necessarily work. I mean, he's going up against the council members who represent Black Los Angeles primarily.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like, they chose, and Curran Price chose employment projects. Like, he got the most money, and he is spending it on targeted local hire included.
Yeah.
This for most of the, I would be shocked if the council couldn't put together 10 votes between the districts that are getting most of the money, between the ones that aren't getting that much money but don't want to go up against their colleagues who have chosen how to spend this very specifically, and even council members like Joe Buscaino, who didn't want this money to be reallocated in the first place, but is getting the third most money after Harris Dawson and Price because he has a low-income district.
It's
just, there's it seems not, like a miscalculation to me.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem like Garcetti has to know that this is going to get overwritten, right? Like that's how it seems to me.
I don't know. I mean, like, maybe they go back to the negotiating table and there's like a compromise in some way, but like, I don't know why he would do this to just get owned.
It does seem like you're saying, it seems like a massive uphill battle to fight against 10 votes coming in, out in favor of the original spending plan. There are a handful of council members who were not part of the original allocation process. But again, like you're saying, they would have to choose to make this their issue in favor.
And to go up against Nuri Martinez, who they, in all likelihood, will be needing to work with much longer than Garcetti.
Yeah. Garcetti is a lame duck mayor.
That's not a choice.
Yeah, and really. So, you're coming into the council. You would have to want to make this your issue, even though, by all appearances, the mayor has thrust it on you without it actually having been your issue originally.
Yes.
So it is a I am curious what the underlying goal is here. It does seem like in the past, with the sort of like everybody wins culture that has existed in City Hall, it is possible that a compromise is reached just so that nobody has to go to the press and say they were brutally owned. But it is, but whether that will make any actual change or if it is just something more sort of facial, just so that Mayor Garcetti can say that he is now actively participating in local politics again,
right,
I guess we have to wait to see.
There were more dramatic revelations related to the city council this week. Last week, I talked a lot about what to look out for with committee assignments. Nuri Martinez assigning the 20 different committees that different members of the LA City Council make up. That was supposed to happen under Herb Wesson when he was council president. That typically happened after the first meeting of the new city council. It was a little delayed this time, although it turned out after our episode came out on Monday people sent me emails showing that Mark Ridley Thomas, new council member, had already announced 5 days earlier that he had been appointed as chair of the Homelessness and Poverty Committee, which had not been shared with any other council members. A lot of them found out about it a week later. He just sent it out as a press release. So that was some back channel conversation. I guess he released it because he wanted to commit Nuri Martinez to it after she promised him.
Or he like didn't read the fine print on the embargo well enough. He's like, so I got this. I've been here Beverly before. Press. I don't need to look at this.
But then on Christmas Eve, the full committee assignments did come out. And there's a lot in here. It was sort of a red wedding moment to some extent.
Yeah.
We talked about how Nuri Martinez has gone up against some progressive elements in the city, both on the city council and people that have made up like protesters outside her house and people asking the city to do more around homelessness and COVID relief. That energy of that adversarial energy seems to have been taken out on Councilmember Mike Bonin, who was pulled off of the Homelessness and Poverty and Budget Committees, two of the most prominent committees in the city. He's still chair of the Transportation Committee. All of the Homelessness and Poverty was completely revamped. It used to be Mitch O'Farrell as chair, Monica Rodriguez, Marquise Harris-Dawson, Mike Bonin, and David Rue. David Rue is off the council. Only Monica Rodriguez is left. Now, it is chaired by Mark Ridley Thomas. It's him, Monica Rodriguez, Kevin De Leon, Nithya Raman, and Joe Buscaino.
A lot of new faces.
All three of the new council members are on homelessness and poverty. They all ran on that issue, that it has been a major focus for them, and it feels like it's kind of like, great, you take care of this.
Kind of gives you a sense of the pecking order, too. You get the, if you get the sense that, like I do, potentially all three of the new council members wanted that committee in particular, Mark Ridley Thomas being named chair is pretty telling. I mean, obviously he has a statewide profile on this issue as a as an elected official.
The other big headlines, one of the biggest ones is we talked about the ad hoc committees designed to deal with just like big goings on in the city at that moment. And the ad hoc committee on police reform is gone. It's dead.
Oh.
Because they fixed it. Because they were like, we're done.
Mission accomplished. Yes, we're done.
Hmm.
I had talked last week about like Herb Wesson was chair of it. Who's going to be the new chair as we figure out what to do about police reform? And the answer is nobody. The committee has vanished.
No longer exists. I mean, yes. I think reasonable that you would get confused on this, Hayes, since you live in Silver Lake, but low-income communities don't actually want police reform. That was a misunderstanding. So why have this committee?
Other big headlines. I was a little surprised to see the Plum Committee. I talked about on last week. That's the committee that you are on if you want there to be a 50% chance that you end up in prison. And I talked about how Curran Price and John Lee have both been implicated in various FBI and investigations related to corruption, in particular stemming from development and the dealings with Plum, the Planning and Land Use Committee. John Lee is still on Plum. Curran Price is not.
Okay.
Curran Price was replaced with Mark Ridley Thomas. I can't imagine that anyone would ask off that committee. I do believe it's very possible that on homelessness and poverty, Mitch O'Farrell was just like, please get me out of
that. That was a tap out for sure.
Yes. But that is a choice to pull off Price and replace him. And also to keep Lee, which is kind of surprising.
Is Price still heading up economic development?
Price is still heading up economic development. Nithya Raman was placed on that committee, and she was made the chair of Information Technology and General Services, which is considered to be one of the whammy committees. It doesn't meet that often. That's sort of like do your time at the...
But that's also what she ran on. So that is actually could be really great.
Did.
Yeah, I mean,
especially
I'm
how
excited.
It intersects with homelessness.
Yes.
Yeah, she could do a lot with that position, for sure. No other really big changes that I can see. Kevin DeLeon he's the chair of the Immigrant Affairs, Civil Rights, and Equity Committee. That's another big surprising thing. He got a huge haul. Nuri Martinez was very, very generous to him. And in the context of the two of them potentially being opponents for mayor, it's interesting. It almost suggests that like she doesn't necessarily see it that way and is maybe not planning a run, especially now that Garcetti is staying in office and she's not going to be acting mayor for any amount of time. So she might be settling into the council president role and considering De Leon as kind of a potential ally as he runs for mayor. But he's on the climate committee. I mean, like, he got what I would imagine is basically everything that he asked for.
A potential ally, but also a potential rival, right? For, like, you know, keep him happy so that he doesn't, if he doesn't get mayor, then he
sure
might run for council president.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's totally possible, too. So that's the update on the committee assignments. We do need to give Alyssa time to take a very well-deserved victory lap. Her long battle with the Shake Alert LA app is over. It ended this week, and she won. Tell us what happened and give us your victory speech.
Well, first, I just want the app has been sunsetted, and if you're hearing this, you only have a few more days left. So, you know, it will. If there's a major earthquake between now and the end of the year, we're completely fucked. But if you download the States app, which was already in development when we announced this app 2 years ago, which you remember that we rushed to get out just so he could fulfill his promise, Mayor Garcetti, to have it ready by the end of 2018. It popped up in the App Store on like the last day of 2018. And then they had a press conference like in January of 2019 just to say that it was done. And there's been... we can put together a highlight reel or something of, you know, a special podcast series of just our earthquake coverage from the past 2 years to show how shaky it has been. But I just want to first give a brief moment of silence for Shake Alert LA. And that is also coincidentally the sound that you would have heard just before a major earthquake.
That's the only sound it ever
on the way to
made.
Your city.
Honestly, like, I feel like we have to pour one out for what became an LA Twitter tradition of when there was an earthquake, not only do you go post about it, but you go answer Alyssa's question, did you get an alert from the My Shake Alert app? And the answer is always no.
But it did work once. It did work once.
Yeah.
It did,
but then it didn't. It worked in some places. It didn't work everywhere.
It was a very difficult earthquake to send out alerts for. And the reason that it didn't, I'll defend them for a minute. And the reason we didn't get alerts for the big Ridgecrest one is because Shake Alert made not a mistake, but like it makes an estimate, and the estimate was actually lower than it was supposed to be for what we would have gotten an alert for. But
That's the message. It never made any mistakes. It worked perfectly the entire
time. It worked
time
as designed, according to
mission accomplished. Time to move
that's,
on.
That's why we're getting rid of it.
And
it was.
Yeah.
It had no problems.
It worked so well.
You know what? You go out on a high note. And also, I mean, talk about a graceful winner, Alyssa Walker.
Yes.
Giving
masterclass.
But I will say, for
so much credit to the city of LA in this moment.
Who have had this app on your phone, I'm sorry. And you can download My Shake. I don't know what it is. My Shake. You'll find it. My Shake in the App Store. Mm-hmm. And that's the one developed by Northern California. So I'm sure they're also taking a victory lap here with their seismologists. Mm-hmm. And then I personally like another app, Quake Alert, which has really only delivered the most reliable warnings to me personally. That could be my phone or where I'm located, but they do a lot of commercial applications also. So they're working closely with like a lot of like Metro and all these other places to, you know, try to see how they can, you know, get their warnings for like transit and opening doors to like fire stations and, you know, all the Universal, for example, I think is one of the people they work with. So there's going to be a lot that came from it. I think maybe LA probably did learn a lot from having this app on our phones for 2 years.
Name one thing. When Mayor Garcetti leaves office and it's time for him to take a big executive job at Uber, this whole experience will be great. Those guys love failure. They talk about it all the time. You learn more from failures than you do from successes. And so that's really, I think that's the story here. He did himself a solid.
2021, let's get into it. Listening back to last year's end of year episode, what's most shocking to me is what we considered to be the biggest stories of 2019 and how none of these
matter.
Would even like show up on our radar compared to what happened this year. Alyssa, your biggest story of last year was the May massacre, the housing bills that got killed in the state government, which happened again this year.
Yeah.
And none of us are going to talk about as the biggest stories of the year. Scott, you mentioned Nipsey Hussle's death, which had happened all the way back in March of 2019.
Right. Well, that still does matter.
Yes. I talked about but also like compared to this year, this is the year that Kobe Bryant died. None of us will be mentioning that as the biggest story of the year. I mentioned the firebombing of just backlash around homelessness, the firebombing of the Eagle Rock encampment, and rising tensions around this issue. I said the time that our only hope was a recession in terms of reducing, not something that I wanted to happen, but that's the only thing that was going to bring rents down. And then instead, we basically got a recession that didn't really, so far, meaningfully bring rents down. In 2018, we talked about the Koreatown protests. Compared to this year, just the magnitude of what went down in this city it's totally on another level. So I'm curious, for starters, what each of you think was the biggest, most representative, impactful story of this year.
I can go first. The most representative story of this year, I'm going to have to pick two specific, in my mind, very closely related incidents. One is the murder of Andres Guardado by police. Mm-hmm. The other is the murder of Dijon Kizzy. I have spent a lot of hours in the street this year in response to both of these killings by police of two young men. A Latinx security guard who lived in Koreatown. The other, Dijon Kizzy, a young man who lived in Palmdale, was visiting friends in Westmont, both of whom were killed by sheriff's deputies in circumstances that are incredibly troubling. The kinds of things that I think if there were even slightly more video footage than exists in either case, these would have been as big of news nationally as George Floyd or Breonna Taylor in Louisville. The circumstances surrounding both of these murders have been, I think, discussed at length here and elsewhere. So I'll keep it brief on that score. But I do just want to say, like, in terms of a year that has been defined so much by, I wouldn't even say it has been more defined by state violence against Black and Brown individuals. I would say it has been much more defined by popular resistance to the state use of power to end the lives of Black and Brown individuals. I think these stories have really stuck with me. I spent a lot of time, in particular in the case of Dijon Kizzy, actually going through just shot by shot of what happened in that case. And we're talking about somebody who was shot 19 times in broad daylight by sheriff's deputies who changed their stories an incredible number of times, and looking at the frame by frame footage that exists, generally speaking, only from like Ring cameras on somebody's door, really cemented in my mind forever just the images of somebody who by no stretch of the imagination should have died, should be dead. But there is no question to me that that really stuck with me in terms of just representing where we are currently. I don't think that politically speaking, we talk about $90 million going to this, that, or the other thing. I don't think that anything has changed politically in terms of where we're at the end of this year. But it is that story that most represents to me the place where we are currently and from where we need to proceed in order to make change here.
What is yours, Alyssa?
Well, maybe mine builds off of Scott's a lot, because you look at how both of those shootings were covered by our local media. And like you said, they could have and should have been national stories. I guess within a certain group of people, they were. But then you look at, and like you said, Scott, the information was right there for anyone to look at. And even the lies were right there when the sheriff's department give these press conferences that are completely false, and you can see they're standing there and holding up their hands next to footage that so clearly contradicts what they're saying. And then you have groups like, you know, you have the local media who is taking that footage and just cranking out headlines, sensationalistic headlines, local media being like television media, where it's so far from what even you could see as a person just watching what's going on.
That's a really good point. I want to just shout out real quick to Sarah Suleiman, who, as far as I'm aware, is still the only journalist who is actually... She was the person who found that you could see the gun in Dijon Kizzy's possession sort of like skidding out of the frame, far from being pointed at any of the deputies. I haven't seen anybody else report on that, but...
No, and it seems like it's been... I was going to say, like, that's been like a forgotten story. You have all the advocacy around and the momentum and the... And so many of protests and, you know, you have had this endless energy being directed towards bringing attention once again towards these families and these victims. And there's just no repercussions, and there's no even it not. I said TV journalism, but it's also places like the LA Times, like, just wrote like a very accepting the facts as we take them, mm-hmm. as they're being delivered to us by the sheriff's department. And I think, for me, the kind of overarching moment where I started to notice like how bad it was one of those days in May when people had marched like all through Hollywood and all past the mayor's house and had walked all the way downtown to City Hall, and we're standing in front of City Hall, and there was an earthquake that day, I remember, and it was like this huge moment, and people realized that a lot of people didn't even know that Black Lives Matter had been protesting at the same time every single week for years in that same place. And Hayes, you had this wonderful moment when you were recounting that, Dr. Malina Abdullah saying, "We didn't go anywhere. Where were you?" And I think the fact that we have so failed from a media perspective, I'm putting it myself, that we haven't really started to understand the consequences of our actions as people who are trying to represent these stories to the public. I mean, that was a real moment for me where I looked around and said, well, this is something that has to change in a bigger way. And we started to see maybe the inklings of that reckoning for media. And I'll count, you know, my company in the same vein. Like, we've had these same conversations, and there's been some people who have left our company, and changes are starting to happen. But man, just to see those the chyrons on the bottom third of these broadcasts that who wrote those and how could you possibly not see this situation as anything but this problem that needs to be confronted in our city and represent it any other way as making it like the sheriffs did something right here. I mean, it just cuts to my heart to be part of something that has taken this long to maybe figure that out. And I hope that what we're doing here is a small part of, you mentioned Sara, like a lot of other journalists have done. We had LAS, yeah. KPCC's,
so Joseph many, Wong there's so arrested. Many picked from this year.
Yeah.
We had Lexis Olivier Ray from LA Taco writing about his experiences being brutalized by police during a protest. There's so many moments where we had this local media kind of breakthrough where we started to change that narrative. And I hope that we're part of it. And I hope that LA media and advocates are seeing themselves as part of it, because it really is happening. It's going to be really hard, but it is happening.
For mine's in a similar vein. I want to talk also about what we all kind of wished for 2020 in the same conversation and what ended up actually happening. I think beyond any of the specific shootings, what People's Budget and BLM managed to do to turn the attention of so many people in the city towards the city budget, towards how much money goes to LAPD, leading to where we are now, exiting 2020 with the Police Protective League in pretty open confrontation with like most of the elected leaders in the city. None of us coming out of 2019 could have possibly predicted that dynamic. There's just no, I mean, like that was,
it would have seemed completely asinine to like, why would you even ever suspect that? It's just totally unpredictable.
They had just raised their salaries to such a degree that they were asking other city departments to make cuts to account for that in boom times.
Right.
And so what those organizations that like BLM and their partner groups that have been working for so long to draw attention to this issue, how successful they were, you know, beyond like the specific dollars and cents, how successful they were at like making people aware of city government at all. And like the culture that has now been created around making demands of these elected officials. You have Services Not Sweeps today getting hundreds and hundreds of people to send emails to Mayor Garcetti to stop the sweeps campaign from happening to the encampments of people who are homeless. I mean, and that's kind of what that feeds into what we all wished for 2020 also. Both Alyssa and Scott, you both mentioned people in positions of power needing to either kind of start walking the walk, or that we just need like total change in leadership. And we did see people swept out of government, whether it was Herb Wesson, Jackie Lacey, David Rue. And Scott, you mentioned the cozy relationship between people like Mayor Garcetti and other elected leaders in the city and the Trump administration, which sort of receded to the background as issues became more about funding for COVID rather than like working with the administration on homelessness issues and things like that. That's what we talked about a lot in 2019. But it was kind of a wave election that resulted from this new attention to a huge degree. I had talked about wanting, what, like both from us and from other like local media organizations to help people get more engaged, to find places to plug in. And that did happen, but it was BLM and People's Budget, I think, that really were the first step towards making that happen to the amazing degree that it did. So what are our wishes for 2021? It's a very ambiguous year in a lot of ways, but we also sort of know what we're in for with the lack of funding that the city has now. Like we've gone from January 2019 to having basically a surplus, except after those labor deals were made, to now we have this huge hole in the city budget. Services are going to have to be cut. We're potentially entering another 2009-2010 period in the city. What are your hopes in that context for 2021?
Well, can I pose a slight variant on it? Since none of us really talked about the pandemic as our... It's related, but it's yeah, part of it. Yeah. But when do you think that we will have defeated it, if in 2021, when life starts to go back to normal? Not that we want the old normal. We want a new normal.
Right.
But when do you think... What are your hopes and maybe a realistic hope for when that happens?
End of summer, I feel like is that's kind of just when I think, you know, end of September basically.
I mean, it honestly could even be before that, not for good reasons, but like the virus is just ripping through the county in such a way that like I think the latest estimates are that something close to a quarter of people in LA County have already had COVID. And so add to that people getting vaccinated. I think you might see it getting knocked down as soon as spring. And not that like people will be getting back to normal necessarily, but things are open now. And I think you just maybe won't see the same. I don't think we'll see the same degree of spread and illness after winter.
I honestly feel almost exactly the opposite. I think that it will still be spreading, but I think that people's discipline and also the political messaging, which already is pretty much wishy-washy, will have atrophied to the point that people will be getting back to normal before it is actually safe to do so.
And will lead to as big of an outbreak as we're having like right now.
We were told this was the final wave by Gavin Newsom.
Right, so. That's right. This is the final surge. Yeah, I mean, it's who knows. I don't. Hopefully, this will be the worst surge that we ever see. But it would take a lot, I think, to get us to a point where we had something approximating herd immunity between now and the end of spring.
Yeah, I just really hope that I don't even. I've pretty much resigned that my children will not be going back to school, LUSD. And it was so funny because my daughter, this school year, I mean, not until next school year. And it was so funny because my daughter like drew this picture for her teacher who she has never met in person.
Wow.
Oh my God.
And.
Wow.
The teacher was so smart because, you know, she's just done such a wonderful job and so great. But she was drawing a picture of her meeting her teacher and three of her best friends from her class who she's never met either.
This is unfathomable to me.
It was just like, they're so resilient. Many students do not have it as good as we've had it. Mm-hmm. I can't say enough for like how amazing the everything has been with the schools in light of very chaotic messaging and very troubling and scary things sometimes happening. I think they've been very consistent. And I look back at everything that happened with the teachers unions and like what UTLA did. I mean, set the stage for this to be a place that kept a lot of kids and teachers alive and families alive. And I it's okay if they don't go back to school for the rest of the year now, because I know they've done such a good job at taking what could have been really scary and really horrible. And you look at a place like New York City where everybody just got super mad at the mayor, like consistent, like every week. Cause the response was different every day. You know, it was just like, they couldn't get it together and they were fighting with the governor or whatever. But, this is both just like a thank you and also like a wish, but I really do hope that we can all go back to school in August and feel good about it. And also feel like the city is taking that part of it seriously enough to make sure that we are making the city safe to go to school. And I just...
Not treating playgrounds like an afterthought, maybe.
Not forgetting the families, because that's what it really all came down to. I mean, there all the conversations about people being able to work or not work or what was open or what was not open, there was a huge number of people who are just stuck home with their kids the whole time. And like moms who had to drop out of the workforce because the dads got paid more or couldn't care the same for their children. So that's what we need to start repairing and what we need to work towards fixing. And right. just a thank you to LAUSD and to UTLA for really saving lives. And I say that very, very seriously. We know that you've done the right thing.
I can go. I came into 2020 kind of optimistic about how engaged people were getting and just like political shifts that were happening. I am still an idiot, and I'm optimistic going into 2021 as well. I think in a city like LA, where you know people, like the stereotype at least is that people are not very engaged with the city itself, or more focused on national politics and their own neighborhoods. What we saw this year, where the traditional centers of power in the city were that power being distributed among so many more people who were getting engaged, I think could have huge political implications and policy implications for 2021. There's will now for better tenant protections and new policy around homelessness. And I hope the conversation also turns back to climate and smog issues. There was an editorial in the LA Times today about how the headline was Southern California is losing the battle against smog and things have to turn around in 2021. 2020, after that period in March when the pandemic was first beginning, where we were like, wow, look at how clean the city is with fewer cars on the road. It ended up being one of our smoggiest years ever, the smoggiest since 1997 in terms of number of days above the federal health standards. My wish is that people in power use the will that is now out there and like take this opportunity to ride this like wave of interest for their own benefit, like for their own potential success, to make very significant change in the city. I think LA could, coming out of the pandemic, have a real collective moment that's really, really positive. But to a large extent, it depends on elected officials listening to the changes that have been made. We don't have, it's not an election year, so there's not an up and down like prediction to make there. But I think this is like things will start to feel different in terms of how responsive LA electeds are to that kind of policy. Scott?
I'm going to defy what you just said about it not being an election year and say my hope is that my wish is that council member John Lee becomes the first LA city council member of all time to become recalled for his corrupt behavior as chief of staff to Mitchell Englander. It's never happened in the city of LA.
Never? Wow.
A mayor has been recalled, but a council member has never successfully been recalled.
What are we doing with our lives? Come on.
This is the moment. We should, if there were the reason why I think that's so important is because I think it provides a good bridge between the 2020 elections in which progressives and leftists were, I would say, very successful in local elections. The state elections, of course, were a bit more dismal, but it provides a good bridge between the 2020 elections and the 2022 elections, and a means to harness some of the energy that is now, I think, in search of a home. And it's certainly an uphill battle in the most conservative district. However, we've had a challenger who is running on Green New Deal policies and things like that in two separate elections come within a hair's breadth of beating John Lee. And that was without the knowledge that he had been, you know, committing misconduct in office.
That hurts. Mm-hmm. Oh, that was the week after the election.
And it wasn't accidental. Yeah.
No, it was not.
No, it was
so
not.
That's my wish for 2021.
While it's not an actual election year, the election season has already kind of begun. People are jumping into the mayor's race. There's more action around different city council races. And yeah, it's going to be a year of fighting off backlash when it comes to the George Gascon reforms, when it comes to people that are going to try and take out Mike Bonin and Council District 11. Like, if that is successful by 2022, then all of the progress that we've made in the last year will be wiped out and then some. We'll be in a much worse place than when we started. And so that work is going to be a big part of this year.
Totally.
We commit to never missing an episode this year either. Thank you so much for listening.
No, there's one more thing. There's one more thing, remember?
Oh, that's right. Oh, God, I was so excited for this.
Well, I wanted to make sure that we didn't end the show on like a super bummer note, because I knew we would be talking about this stuff and it would be like kind of depressing to hear, you know, about our predictions and wishes. So I really wanted to just give you guys a gift, a New Year's.
Is this, are you talking to the listeners or just to me and Scott?
I think it's for the listeners, but specifically for you and Scott.
Great. Okay.
Because I just wanted to really celebrate in what it was in many ways the most, I think, important thing that happened in 2020 that we didn't actually talk about on today's show. So if you just give it a minute, I'm going to share my screen so you can hear the sound.
Okay. And all we know is that Alyssa has a New Year's gift for us, and Scott and I don't know what it is.
Yes, you don't know. You don't know what it is. Share sound.
We built this target. We built this target by Home Depot. Built this target. We built this target by Home Depot.
Oh my God.
Say you are building a regular shopping place. Say you don't care if it is zoned for that kind of space. Knee deep in the CEQA, council's in the fight.
She worked at CEQA.
Too many stories raising up the height. We built this target by Home Depot. Built this target. We built this target by Home Depot.
And it wasn't even your story of the year.
Someone's always paying. His name is Doug Haynes. You know. Association name. He just wants to stop this in a half unbuilt phase. He calls it irresponsible. We'd rather see it raised. Got steady, not Murata. We claim you both know. Don't you remember? We built this target. We built this target. We built this target by Home Depot. Built this target. We built this target by Home Depot.
I'm so
just
impressed.
Just wanna walk on Sunset. Don't wanna cross the street. Please give us a sidewalk. Looking for a miracle, breaking all the
drivers on Western heading into that parking garage.
Go steady, La Mirada. Hate to say we told you so. Don't you remember? We built this target. We built this target by Home Depot.
I'm actually mad about how good this
is. You're once again assuming it's over. It's not a safe assumption to make.
It's over.
Okay.
It's over.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
That's so funny.
That was weirdly, like, emotional for me. Like,
right?
I mean, wow.
First of all, I can't believe you did that. And second of all, I'm just so amazed by how on point
every
line.
It was a conspiracy with Brian Holmes, who you have to thank for keeping this a secret after I floated the idea.
Oh, my God.
If you need, like, a Grace Slick effect applied to your singing, I think, like, Brian Holmes is the person to go to.
Oh, my God.
The commitment to the vocals was really, really... just inspired by the source material, obviously. Doug Haynes is already figuring out, he's already learning intellectual property law to sue you over this.
This song creates an unsafe pedestrian environment. I love this.
We snuck it in. The best moment of 2020 on the show.
I kept jumping in because I have never actually listened to the entire song, and I don't know when it ends. It might have gone on forever.
Longer than that, and you would be surprised to know it goes on for probably another minute. And it was written by Bernie Taupin.
Oh, wow. We will be posting that separately as its own file to share and distribute to your friends. What a gift. Thank you so much, Alyssa. Thank you,
You're
Brian,
welcome.
For your work all year. And thank you to all of our listeners, all of our Sepulveda pass holders. We love you, and we will see you in 2021. Bye. I wonder what is going on. Hello.